wonder who feels included and who feels excluded. And how we close that gap. How we include those who feel excluded. How we include those who want to be excluded. How do we honor each individual bird? I read a quote, not related to this, but appropriate to this, by Simone Weil. Each being cries out silently to be read differently. And I think that is our greatest task, to read each difference we encounter, and that is myriad within ourselves. Differences are arising all the time. In the people we meet, differences are arising all the time. How do we bear witness to each arising? Someone spoke of meditation. I guess the word I'm most comfortable with, the most familiar with, is Zazen. But Zazen meditation comes down to being, just being. And as simple as it sounds, because there is nothing we have to do, it doesn't require anything extra of us. In fact, it requires us to let go of some things, let go of the extra, and just be in the moment, attentive to each being crying out silently to be read differently. So how do we include the great diversity of beings we encounter? Zen sees identity as fluid. And one thing we're certainly learning is that who and what we call woman is more fluid than we thought. And it's almost confusing to us that something at one time we thought so fixed now has a fluidity we can't quite put into words. It requires a different way of thinking. And we are just adjusting to that different way of thinking. The story that I'm going to share with you this morning is from a collection of stories. Stories are sometimes called koans, are the ways that in the Zen Buddhist lineage we often teach. It's usually a story, a conversation between a teacher and a student, a quote of a teacher, a question. But it's always subtle. It's what we would call paradox if we were limited to words. But in a wordless place, there's no paradox. Everything exists at once. Opposites exist together. Opposites create each other. Opposites define each other. So labels are not as solid as we like to think of them. And the label woman applies to so many beings. How do we include them all? Or how do we support a life, a practice that empowers all women? Feminism is something that each person can define for themselves. There's a general definition. And when I looked it up, it was interesting to me that there was first a definition, the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes. And second, the definition, organized activity on behalf of women's rights and interests. That's very similar to what we encounter in Zen practice, and that is, we're taught certain things. We have certain concepts that we think of as ethics, as teachings, oneness. But no matter what word you think of, what word you use, it all comes down to how do you live it? How does it get lived? How does it get put into the world? And that's the question I have about this inclusion. The first story that I want to share with you is about the first inclusion of women in Buddhism. Mahapajapati opens the door. This is a story from 6th century BC in India. And how historically factual it is, in detail, I don't know. But Mahapajapati was the aunt and foster mother of the Buddha. His mother died shortly after he was born. And at the time of this story, many women were turning to her. This is after the Buddha's awakening, after the Sangha had been formed of men, the Sangha of men. And many women were turning to her for counsel when their husbands and sons left home to join the Buddhist daughter. She was the first woman to ask the Buddha if women could also join. The Buddha replied, "Don't set your heart on this." She asked two more times, the story goes, and received the same answer. Don't set your heart on this. and she went away in tears. Later, Mahaprajapati and 500 other women cut off their hair, put on saffron-colored robes, and walked barefoot for hundreds of miles to where the Buddha was teaching. Weeping, they stood outside the gates. Ananda saw them there and asked Mahaprajapati, "Why are you crying?" Ananda was her son and the Buddha's cousin and a disciple of the Buddha in this first early sangha. She said, "Because the Buddha does not permit women to ordain." Ananda went to the Buddha and said, "Your aunt is standing outside with swollen feet, covered with dust, crying because you do not let women ordain. It would be good, Lord, if women had permission to ordain." And the story is that the Buddha replied, "Enough, Ananda. Don't set your heart on this." Ananda asked two more times to no avail. And then he asked, "Are women able to realize the fruits of the way? Are women able to awaken to this broad view, this vastness, this vast being that generally doesn't need a label?" And the Buddha said, "Yes, Ananda, they are." So Ananda said, "Well, since women are able to realize this vastness, since Mahaprajapati was so kind to you, caring for you, suckling you at her own breast, surely it would be good if women were allowed to ordain." And the story is that the Buddha relented, and the Sangha of Women was born. When I was first taught this story, I was also taught that the Buddha said it will set Buddhism back 500 years or some large number. And that the abbot then of Zen Center of Los Angeles was asked, "Well, what do you make of this 500 years? And he said, "Well, it was worth it." What really struck me when I read this time was inclusion is hard in a culture, in a society, in a group of people used to living a certain way. Taking the men from them is hard, but probably taking the women might cause even more upheaval. How do we make that kind of change that cries out to be made, but it's also going to stir things up? We're really at that point now, it seems to me. And so, as I really thought about the honesty about what inclusion really means, what radical inclusion is, I had to look more clearly at what makes it so challenging for us. This story takes place over 2,500 years ago. And even now, there are Buddhist women whose ordinations are restricted. It was quite a while before, in my lineage, we began chanting the names of women ancestors. And that was in the around 1990s. So we're beginning at the 6th century BC. Chanting the names of a patriarchal lineage. And only recently have we started chanting the names of women. And there was some opposition, some objection. And it required research and finding the names. And that chant ends, and all the women whose names are forgotten and left unsaid. Inclusion is not easy. In fact, it's not easy on either side. Whoever feels themselves being included after many years or whoever wants to welcome them. I have had many times of being in a group being included after not having been included for a very long time. And only recently, I think, have I been able to look clearly at how difficult I was to include sometimes. Because if you've been left out for whatever reason, even your own, of your own making, you may not make it easy to include you. And if you've never noticed until recently who you've excluded, you may step on their toes, or worse. And all of that takes dealing with rather than running from. I received an email this morning from someone I know speaking about illness, the illness of a Zen teacher, and the way that she sometimes finds herself hoping that meditation or zazen will prevent her suffering. But But then she comes back to the reality that the teaching of wholeness, the teaching of Zen, is that the way to oneness is through. This is not a way around difficulty. It's an invitation to walk through. And it's a statement that this path through is workable. That inclusion, radical inclusion, is doable. But not as fast, maybe, as we think, and not always comfortable. An important aspect, I think, of acknowledging any of the suffering that we've inherited in this country is not trying to rush it, is a patience with it. At least that is something that I've learned, especially in this political atmosphere. Because I was born into a community with a child's view that solutions were coming. Things were going to be better. And in a way that they're definitely better, but far more complicated and demand so much more of us if we are to include all of the women from the different classes, from the different ethnicities, from the different religions and religious beliefs, the different incomes. To include all of life in ending suffering isn't it as idealistic as it sounds, but it does take a practice. It takes more than a theory. The word that I ran across, and I'll admit I was not familiar with the word, but I find out it's been around since the 1980s. It is now a buzzword. Intersectional feminism, which maybe many of you have heard of. It arose from what some black women call double jeopardy. And that is being both black and female. And the oppressions that come with that, the impressions that one has to navigate with that. But it's not just true for any particular group of women. It's not just true for black women. This is true for each individual. The circumstances of each person's life are relevant to what they call feminism, what their needs are. And the challenge that we face as one being is how to bear witness to that and carry it out. I was at an Indian reservation a few years ago, It had taken us a long time to get permission from them to come and visit, bear witness to what had happened there. It was at Wounded Knee. And one of the things, well, there were two things. One is that we were asked to come, to listen, to pray with them, but not to tell them what to do, not to give any advice. And that was the only instruction we got, and we were very cautious and listened. And one of the things I was struck by was the pattern I saw of women who had, I supposed, from my own experience, been considered safer than the men. And so many of them worked, had jobs, were teachers, were mothers, raised children, but the men suffered greatly. Unemployment, alcoholism, and other problems. And the reason they had decided to take a chance on us was because their middle school children were starting to commit suicide because they didn't see a life of hope. One of the things that makes the issue to me broader than just women's issues is that dynamic. What it means when what you want is to save a family, a group of people, not just limit to one gender or one biological sex. So my big question is, how do we include all of this? There is the need to see each, read each being differently. And the need to know that all of this is one. And in that sense, it's not unusual to find a Buddhist teaching like this one, Moshan's Mountain Summit. This is a teaching from China, 6th century AD. The monk Guanxi Xian was sent by his teacher Lin Qi to meet Master Moshan, a powerful woman teacher. When he arrived at Mount Moshan, where she taught, he refused to bow or to take off his traveling hat. He asked, "Where is Moshan?" And Moshan, the woman teacher, replies, "The summit cannot be seen." He asked, "Who is Master of Mount Moshan?" She replied, "Without the form of a man or a woman." Guanxi, the student, says, "Why doesn't she transform herself?" Which was a common question. If you're a wise woman, why not transform yourself into a man? Because there was the belief that somehow a woman couldn't awaken. She had to first become a man. She had to first be born as a man. Moshan said, well, she's not a wild fox spirit or a ghost. What would you have her become? The teaching really is that being is a temporary, fluid thing. And there's no fixed male forever, female forever. There is really just being. And at that, Guan Xi bowed, took off his hat, and became gardener for her monastery, and stayed for 3 years. There were frequently replies to questioning men, students. Neither female nor male, just being. The rest is appearance, and appearances change. Thank you.
Arthur. In your teal books, number 1052. Please rise, embody your spirit.